The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm Denver Frederick, and tonight you're going to spend some time with two wonderful guests who are tackling two urgent problems in the developing world. You will first meet Toby Norman, the co-founder and CEO of Simprints. They have pioneered a biometric solution to a problem bigger than you might have ever imagined, that of identity.
And so, although we don't think about identity a lot, it's actually a massive issue, made even more big by the number of people who don't have it. I mean, 1.1 billion people worldwide without identity is the latest statistics from the World Bank. That's nearly one in every seven people on the planet.
And more than 4 billion people around the world live outside the protection of the law. They're driven from their land, denied basic services, and intimidated by violence. But an organization called Namati has taken on this challenge, and you'll learn how from their founder and CEO, Vivek Maru.
In healthcare, we have long realized you don't just have doctors for healthcare, you know. You got many layers. You got nurses and midwives and, as you said, community health workers. And these community paralegals are kind of the equivalent for law. They can bring law close to people and help people find practical solutions, which oftentimes don't involve the courts. They involve the administrative institutions. They involve creative negotiation.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, November 4th. More than a decade after the Internal Revenue Service began allowing nonprofits to file their returns online, one-third of tax-exempt organizations still choose to submit paper forms, according to data compiled by the Chronicle of Philanthropy. And some of the nation's largest charities and foundations are among those that still file the old-fashioned way. The Cystic Fibrosis Foundation has announced that it will commit at least $100 million over the next 5 years as part of an ambitious effort to address the chronic and intractable infections that are characteristic of cystic fibrosis. The Cystic Fibrosis Foundation has announced that it will commit at least $100 million over the next 5 years as part of an ambitious effort to address the chronic and intractable infections that are characteristic of cystic fibrosis. Across the U.S., 40% of students who enroll in college, including 66% of black students and 53% of Latino students, end up having to take a remedial course where they relearn skills they were supposed to have mastered in high school. 1 out of 10 LGBTQ people said they have left a nonprofit job due to an environment that was not very accepting. And almost one-third said they were depressed at work because of an unwelcoming work environment. And finally, researchers from the Medical University of Vienna released new research showing that microplastics have now entered the human food chain and are present in human feces. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back to speak with Toby Norman of Simprints right after this.
Through Grameen America's groundbreaking microfinance model, tens of thousands of low-income women in New York are getting the financial capital they need to build small businesses and climb out of poverty. Join the movement. Visit GrameenAmerica.org to learn more. Follow the Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/BusinessOfGiving. And now, back to the Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
How effective can you be in helping someone improve their life if they have no formal identification? Likewise, how can they be agents of their own change if they lack that same identification? Difficult? Maybe impossible. Yet, there are over 1 billion people worldwide who find themselves in this very predicament, preventing them access to essential services. Fortunately, there is a young and innovative organization who is tackling this head-on. It's called Simprints, and it's a pleasure to have with us their co-founder and CEO, Toby Norman. Good evening, Toby, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Good evening. Pleasure to be here.
So, Toby, what is the mission of Simprints?
So, at its heart, Simprints' mission is really to transform the way that we fight poverty. What we do is we build technology, like fingerprint biometrics, to radically increase the effectiveness and transparency the way we deliver aid. And our goal is really to make sure that every vaccine, every bed net, every dollar in this fight is reaching its intended recipient.
This all started at a hackathon at the University of Cambridge over in England and has evolved in a fashion that I suspect you had never anticipated. Tell us how Simprints came to be.
So I had never, ever planned to get into technology entrepreneurship, social enterprise. I was going a completely different track. But in 2012, I was doing my PhD at the University of Cambridge, and I spent about 4 years studying frontline nonprofit workers with BRAC in Bangladesh. Mm-hmm. For those who might not be familiar, BRAC is actually currently the world's largest NGO. It's in over 15 countries, has huge programs in healthcare, microfinance, education. I was particularly looking at their health programs. And one of the challenges that I was seeing, and one of the exciting trends that I was also seeing, was the shift towards sort of digital services. So health workers, for example, going house to house in slums, using low-cost mobile smartphones to record patient data. And it was around this time, in 2012, there was actually a hackathon at the University of Cambridge that posed the question, how can we improve the effectiveness of mobile healthcare services? And the pain point that we really thought about and the pain point we came up with was this challenge of patient identification. You know, it seems pretty obvious to us, but actually, if you imagine yourself in the shoes of a community health worker in Bangladesh, there's a child in front of you, and that child has no birth certificate, no vaccine record, no healthcare record. They share a name with maybe hundreds of other kids in that slum. How do you actually link them consistently to a vaccine record so you know which vaccines they've had and which vaccines they need next? And that was really the spark of what took us into a journey of a massive field that we had no idea we were getting into.
You know, to fully appreciate the value of identity, describe to me what my life would be like without it, without any formal identification.
Sure. Well, let's imagine I go into your wallet and I, you know, throw away your driver's license. I'm able to, say, go online and delete your birth certificate, your social security number, any medical insurance numbers you have. Think about what would you be able to do, right? Could you open a bank account without those details? Absolutely not. Would you be able to enroll your kids in school? Definitely no. Would you be able to travel? No. You'd essentially be a refugee within your own country. And so although we don't think about identity a lot, it's actually a massive issue, made even more big by the number of people who don't have it. I mean, 1.1 billion people worldwide without identity is the latest statistics from the World Bank. That's nearly one in every seven people on the planet.
Why is something as fundamental as this hasn't been addressed by now?
It's a good question. I think there's a lot of factors. Really, there's two levels of challenge to identity, or two different approaches to it. One is a foundational identity. So this is an identity that's provided by the government, and that is the government ID that you use to access critical services. Now, in many of the places that Simprints works, countries like Afghanistan, Somalia, and many other countries, actually creating foundational identity systems and making sure those reach, you know, the poorest of the poor, or the last 10%, is incredibly hard. Hasn't been done yet, right? And I think this is still a challenge that many organizations in many countries are working on, and it's getting better, but it's not getting better fast enough. The second layer is functional identity, right? So this is now, let's imagine, it's not your driver's license given to you by the US government, but it's a medical insurance number given to you by your medical insurance or your healthcare provider. Mm-hmm. Now, they also need that identity to deliver care to you. Without that, you're not going to be able to get the care or the access to care that you need. This also is incredibly difficult in countries where we work, like Bangladesh, where the poorest of the poor rarely have any formal identity they can rely on. And so NGOs and other key service providers in this context don't actually have a reliable way to link you to the records. You could use the name, would be an obvious one, but there's huge overlaps in name. For example, in my PhD research in Bangladesh, about 40% of my data set was called some variation of Muhammad, right? So it wasn't reliable. You could use age, but actually in many cases, people don't know their exact date of birth.
That's right.
They can tell you I was born 2 years before the revolution or right after the cyclone, I think around 35, but very often they don't know their exact date of birth. And so what this leads is to huge levels of overlap, duplications, accidental misidentification in the field, which makes it really hard for service providers to know if the care they're providing, whether it's healthcare, education, or something else, is actually reaching the intended audience.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Speaking of revolutions, there's been a revolution going on in biometrics, and you talked about that in your opening, and there's probably no better bang for the buck in biometrics, at least currently, than fingertips. But there are a lot of fingertip scanners out there already. You went out and had to design a new one. Why was that the case?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we're completely agnostic about which biometric modality you use in this context. You know, you can use things like fingerprints, which is very well known. You can use things like facial recognition, iris identification. Mm-hmm. There's a whole field. Simprints works with a couple different modalities, but the one that we really, I think, built the organization on was fingerprints. And when we reason we chose fingerprints is it still gives you incredibly high accuracy per cost, has high levels of cultural acceptability. So, for example, when we first started in Bangladesh, we looked at iris and we looked at facial recognition. But in many contexts, you know, this is Islamic culture. Some women were veiled, and that just meant those weren't appropriate. Mm-hmm. So finding something that was both culturally appropriate, but also gave us the accuracy needed was really key. We never planned to build our own biometric technology. even before we started, we suspected that would be way too hard. But when we started testing scanners in the field and saying, look, biometric like a fingerprint could be a great way to link someone to the healthcare records, we were shocked by how poorly the technology failed. How poorly the technology worked. It constantly failed in terms of accuracy and also in terms of the appropriateness of design. You know, most of these scanners were USB scanners designed to plug into, you know, powerful desktop computers or even online servers. That's not the context we're working in. We're working with mobile health workers who have to go house to house delivering care to patients. So essentially, we had to do two things. The first is we had to figure out why was the accuracy so bad.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we did is we actually took the six leading fingerprint technologies on the market. We put them in a number of different boxes. And we conducted a research study across four countries, enrolling over 135,000 fingerprints from Benin, Zambia, Bangladesh, and Nepal, trying to understand what was highly accurate with last mile populations, really the poorest of the poor. And what we saw consistently was that these are populations who are doing a ton of manual labor. Right? These are farmers. These are day laborers in cities. These are women and housewives sort of cooking on open fires. And what that meant is that we actually saw huge levels of scar, wear, and burns on the fingerprints. And over 70% of the data we saw some type of fingerprint damage. Particularly with women, we actually got a lot of thermal burns on their finger pads because they're cooking, you know, lifting hot pots on off open fires, which meant that when we used the technology that was on the market, it failed. It had error rates over 30%, which is just unusable. So we, I think, derailed a few PhDs while we were at Cambridge together, the co-founding team, and spent our time saying, could we actually optimize technology to deal with scarred and damaged fingerprints so that you could actually identify this group and then package that in a sensor and a technology that was designed for and actually really by community health workers in the field. And that was, I think, the key technical challenge we had to overcome in the early days.
Mm-hmm. And how much more accurate is this scanner that you designed compared to what we have on the market previously?
So according to our studies, and actually still today, I believe that that data set is the largest academic data set of developing world fingerprints out there. The technology is 228% more accurate with open standards than the next best performing technology on the market. And we've used this now in projects in over 11 different countries with over 100,000 beneficiaries and going to a lot more. So I think there's more data to collect. But overall, this we found this to be highly effective.
Yeah. And you touched on this a moment ago, but in developing this hardware scanner, what were some of the things that it had to be capable of to be effective on the front lines in the field? And you guys spent a lot of time living in these communities, so you really knew what would work and what wouldn't.
I mean, we went through maybe 20 different iterations with sort of eight very distinct design pathways, all trying to come to what would actually be required to work in this context. I mean, it had to be rugged, right? Mm-hmm. These are tough conditions. Waterproof, shockproof. It's got to fall, be able to fall off the back of a motorcycle and still work. It needs to actually be ergonomic, which is really key. Something that we often forget is that these are health workers who are interacting with patients who are, you know, very busy. While the health worker is talking to them, the mother is cooking, looking after kids. Maybe the father's coming back from the field. So we need something that was ergonomic that could easily and quickly slip into the palm of someone's hand, take a fingerprint, even with sort of very worn, scarred fingers. And so we had to build this technology. It had to be mobile, it had to be long-lasting, and it had to work completely offline. And that was a really hard challenge to crack because most of the technology that was out there was designed to run on servers. And we needed something that could, although periodically sync data to a server, had to be able to work in the most remote locations with no internet connectivity.
Yeah, and you also built it so it would plug into the international architecture, correct?
That's an excellent point, yeah. Something we realized early on and we were determined not to do was to duplicate the work that many organizations were already doing. So, for example, a lot of great NGOs and governments now are using digital tools to collect data about the services they provide. So, for example, with BRAC, their frontline health workers were actually collecting patient data on low-cost, typically Chinese manufacturer smartphones, and moving that to a central server. We didn't want to recreate this system. What we wanted was something that could plug into existing tools and, one, plug into both the technical platforms out there, but really critical for us, also be interoperable, something that would not lock in people to specific vendors, right? I mean, if you work with Simprints, you can only work with Simprints, but actually adhere to international standards in terms of the way we store biometric data so that these can plug into government schemes, other NGOs, Simprints can be replaced by other vendors, and actually try and get an ecosystem making better quality, more effective, cheaper technology allowing this access rather than trying to dominate the market.
Let's discuss several ways that it can be used. I think we're all familiar with the stories of corruption and incompetence when it comes to the distribution of aid. Now, how is Simprints helping to address that?
So aid is a huge challenge. I mean, there have been studies that have shown that of the, I think, nearly over $2.3 trillion that we've spent on aid, huge percentages of that get lost. I've seen statistics anywhere from 20% to 69% of that never actually making it to its intended recipients. What something like a biometric does, particularly if we combine that with a timestamp and a GPS coordinate, is it tells you three things. It tells you first who received the service, when did they receive the service, and where did they receive the service. We say it's a food subsidy, it's an oil subsidy, or increasingly in the field of international development, it's a cash transfer, whether conditional or unconditional cash transfer. And so if you have those three pieces of data, it makes it much harder, for example, for a middleman to make up lists or names of fake recipients, they're called ghost beneficiaries, and actually say, yes, I've handed out all of these cash transfers to this target population. Here's the list of people who have received them. None of the names on that list are real, but it's so hard to actually check and prove if they received it. Now, if you've got those three pieces of information, you know, A, it's first off incredibly technically difficult to fake any of those pieces of data, but B, you can also go back and back check, did this person actually receive this service, yes or no? And so that radically increases the effectiveness and the transparency in which we deliver critical aid services.
You know, there's also challenges in the developing world around education. And one of those challenges is teacher absenteeism, for that matter, student absenteeism. How is your product used there?
So this is a really interesting one that we never intended to get to. I mean, we started this really just focused on patient identification. But when I started talking to my colleagues who worked in the field of development, they kept on saying, you know, we have the exact same problem in education or in finance or in, you know, all of these other areas. For example, in education, teacher absenteeism is a huge problem globally. We've done a project with D3 Systems and actually the Afghani Ministry of Education looking at the question of how prevalent is teacher absenteeism, right? Because you now have very remote schools where corrupt officials within a ministry could potentially make fake lists of teachers who are supposedly teaching at these schools, but they're not there. They're not coming. Or occasionally real teachers who are, just don't have the incentives or the salary to actually go into the school, and it's so hard to check, are they actually there?
Yeah.
With something like a fingerprint, we can now see, okay, is that teacher in the classroom? Yes or no. And you can even use the same thing for student attendance. So, for example, saying like, when do kids drop out of school? Why are they starting to drop out of school? It's hard to answer those questions if we don't know who's in the classroom in the first place. These were not areas we ever planned to get into at the start, but some of the market has pulled us because there's a real need here that we frankly didn't anticipate. But now I see huge value in trying to solve these problems.
Yeah, and Toby, let's talk a little bit more about vaccination, because in the developing world, 17% of children under the age of 5 die of vaccine-preventable diseases. What impact have you been able to have on that with Simprints?
So this is a big area that we're just getting into. Simprints was very fortunately this year awarded a 2018 Gavi Pacesetter Award for our work in the vaccination space and what we hope to continue doing with Gavi. For those who don't know, Gavi is the Global Alliance for Vaccinations. They've done a huge amount of work in reducing the cost of vaccines and increasing access to vaccines globally. And really, one of the key problems they're trying to focus now is on what they call the fifth child. It's that 20% of people, 20% of children globally, who do not receive the full course of vaccines that they need. Again, a key challenge is identification. It's knowing which children have received vaccinations and which haven't, who's dropped through the cracks. For example, Simprints in the early days, we did a lot of our field testing in Benin with Ministry of Health vaccine clinics. And I can tell you the work that the health workers have to do in this context is incredibly difficult. I mean, picture yourself sort of on a concrete floor, maybe with a tin roof above your head. You've got 60, 80 mothers, many of whom have trekked for hours and hours through the heat to come to the vaccine clinic. There's screaming, crying children everywhere. And you've got three or four health workers who are trying to get all of these kids vaccinated with paper records stacked through the roof. Many mothers, unfortunately, forgetting to bring the vaccine card or losing it or potentially getting water damage. And trying to know which vaccines has a child received and which ones haven't they received is no easy task, which means sometimes that we're restarting courses of vaccinations, we're re-enrolling the same children under different names, and we don't have an accurate sense of who's actually been reached. I sat down with a minister of health once and he asked me, why is it that I get 130% vaccine coverage reports from my different districts, and every year I see vaccine preventable epidemics? Why is that happening? And it's happening because we can't see who we've reached and who we've missed.
Yeah. You know, listening to what you're saying, this is so much more than just a hardware scanner, because I'm just getting an idea of the maintenance of all these records, and I'm sure that's really the backbone of what you do. But, you know, a big piece of all that then is going to be the issues around privacy and security. And I know this is very central to everything you do. Let's start with privacy, the concerns you're mindful of, and what you do to safeguard an individual's privacy.
Yeah. Privacy is a huge concern. It's something really important that you need to address head on. And I think in the past couple of years, it's become something that we can actually on a personal level relate to much more.
For example,
Cambridge Analytica, the Facebook scandals, I mean, this really is an area that is, I think, becoming more and more part of the public consciousness, as it should.
Mm-hmm.
We think about this at a couple of different layers. You know, the first question is, what information do we actually need, right? And that's really critical because there's a temptation, and I know this coming from the research space, to collect tons of data on everything because maybe it could be useful. But actually, Simprints is a privacy-first organization, really makes it very clear that we don't want to collect any information that's not required. The second thing we need to do is think about, how do you genuinely get informed consent in the field from beneficiaries who might not have very high levels of education?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about you, but when I see sort of, you know, the terms and conditions update on my iTunes or Play Store accounts,
78 pages.
I don't read them, right? I click the accept box and I go through. That's actually something that I should not be doing. Could you imagine trying to get genuinely informed consent from someone who's maybe had 5 years of education total in their life? And so Simprints has worked with a team of human rights lawyers, privacy and cybersecurity experts, to actually really craft very clear informed consent in local language, train the workers that we work with to actually deliver those, have fully detailed frequently asked questions about what are we collecting, why are we collecting it. And something we're very proud of is we hold to GDPR privacy mm-hmm. standards. So for those who don't know, this is the European General Data Protection Regulation. It's come into force. Arguably, it's the strictest privacy standards in the world. And so although we work in many places that have little or sometimes no privacy regulations in local government, we hold ourselves to that European standard on every single project we do, no matter where we are, because we think this is critically important.
Yeah, that's great. Because I think sometimes people think the people at the bottom of the pyramid don't deserve the same level of privacy as the rest of us, and they most certainly do. What about security?
Security is a really key one as well, and there's many different layers to security. Security is something, and again, we've seen sort of the hacks even in the past couple of years that have just been shocking to us. Again, Facebook recently, another massive hack. Huge challenge. There's a couple ways we approach it. First is that we always go to the best of the best in terms of who's designing security architecture. So most of our infrastructure is built with Google, who we think are one of the best in the world mm-hmm. when it comes to security. Second thing is we work very hard on the underlying architectures of the technology. So for example, Simprints has zero access to any patient record, any financial record, any education record, any of those details. That information is held in separate databases for the NGO and government partners we work with. Don't touch it. Don't want access to it. What we do is we silo away biometric data and associate that with a randomly generated anonymous unique ID.
Mm-hmm.
That randomly generated anonymous unique ID is the link to someone's healthcare record or their finance record. But that means that you keep the biometric data and the patient or beneficiary data separate. So if there was ever a breach in one of those two databases, you would not have access to the corresponding information. And so that type of architecture design, coupled with best practice encryption across the different layers at which we work, you know, firmware, Bluetooth, mm-hmm. mobile, and cloud, means that you have a really simple, very streamlined data collection system that should arguably be incredibly robust and nearly impossible to break into.
That is good to hear. When you started Simprints, you thought of a couple different business models, kicked them around, but ultimately decided on a nonprofit. What were the factors in making that decision?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question and one that we spent a lot of time thinking about. For those who are actually interested, we did a pretty large landscaping of the different legal options for for-profits, social enterprises, and nonprofits in the UK. We've actually open-sourced those findings because we spent quite a lot of time and worked with a great law firm to figure those out. And so for those who are interested, check out our website, www.simprints.com, and we have the full report available there for other people who are maybe thinking about what are the legal options for them. For us, in the end, we decided to go with a nonprofit model, not a charity, which was actually quite important to us. For the ethos of the organization and how we wanted to structure, we knew that we really wanted to be driven by earned revenues, not just rely purely on philanthropy. I think that has an important place in the system. But we knew we wanted a tight accountability loop to the work we were doing. But at the same time, we wanted to plant a flag in terms of our social impact and our social goals, putting that at the heart of the organization. So we found doing that type of model, that nonprofit business, really for us was the best fit.
Mm-hmm. Well, your first paid contract was with an NGO in Nepal called Possible. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about your earned revenue. How's that going? Are you meeting plan?
Yeah, so that's a fantastic question. This is something we've really focused hard on. So when we started, the entire R&D and the entire organization essentially bootstrapped off grants. Grants and a little bit of philanthropy to get us started up. We went to market about a year and a half ago, so started getting our first earned revenues. We now get 43% of our income from earned revenues, meaning sales to NGOs, to governments, and to other organizations who are using our technology. That's up from 0% 15 months ago, 10% about a year ago. And our goal really within 2 years is to get 80% driven by earned revenues. And that's really important to us, I think, for two reasons. One is we think ethically that's the sustainable route to making sure this technology is going to be working and in it for the long haul. Second is we think that it creates a very important accountability loop for us to build, deploy, and really critically sustain technology that works in the field. Mm-hmm. And this is something that's super difficult, but in the ICT 4D space, sort of the technology for development field, there's a lot of wonderful innovations that I think either struggle to get to the field, or once they get to the field, they're not well sustained. There's a whole bunch of complex reasons we can go into that for, but I think one of the most important is the incentives aren't lined up well. You're not getting paid for keeping that technology working in the field, and that's something we want to do. And so making sure that technology genuinely works day in, day out in the hands of health workers or teachers or whoever we're working with, that's tough to do, but if we're getting paid based on whether or not that happens, we've got the right accountability.
Yeah, no question about it. That's the wonderful thing about earned revenue. You actually know that people really want this.
100%.
If you get a grant, you're not really sure. Maybe the grantee wants it. You know, your values are prominently displayed on your website. Tell us about several of them and the impact that they have had in the way you approach your work.
Sure. So we think about values, you know, pretty simply. As we think values are the rules that we agreed to play by as a team. And so our mission is really objective. It's what we're trying to do. But if how we're going to achieve that mission is just as important as what we're attempting to do. And so we thought long and hard about the values. We've tried to make them non-traditional. A couple ones I really like. One of my favorites is confront the gray.
I like that too.
We work in a complicated field, and I think sometimes we tend to simplify. You know, people put up stuff like integrity on their walls. I think Enron actually had that as one of their, their core values. But look, this is a complicated space. The easy questions are the ones that are black and white, right? The easy questions are the ones that, you know, is this corrupt, yes or no? And if the answer is yes, you don't do it. That's not a really hard conversation. It shouldn't be the conversation we need to have at this stage. But there's a lot of questions like, how much security is enough, right? Mm-hmm. That is not binary. It's not black or white. You can go from very little all the way to so much that the system's unusable, right? The safest thing to always do is to sit on your hands and they'll stay clean forever. But that we don't think works, right? Not only does action require integrity, but we really think integrity requires action. If you see something that's not right, you've got to do something to get in that space. So confront the gray is our value at Simprints, which means, look, we know we're going to be entering complex areas. This is a difficult field with issues like privacy, security, informed consent, use of technology, vulnerable populations. How do we make sure that we actually do at the end of the day the right thing? The most important thing we can do is we talk about it. If we see something that doesn't feel right, we confront the gray at that moment and we raise it and we debate and we disagree and we argue, but we have those critical conversations. I think it was Louis Pasteur who once said that sunlight is the best disinfectant.
Yep.
We fundamentally believe that. If we are transparent and we talk about the hard things, we think at the end of the day, more often than not, we're going to get to the right place.
Well, they are definitely an interesting set of values. I don't ever think I've seen robust as fudge on anybody's website as a value. Toby, speak to us about innovation. And I know you have developed very tight and fast feedback loops to help accelerate it. Give us an example of how this works in practice.
Mm-hmm. This, I think, was something that we really took from agile methodologies, which developed really from the software development space, but now are getting applied to a whole bunch of areas of business. And the core concept is that for things that are very complicated, it's often impossible to predict in your planning cycles how they're going to play out. Mm-hmm. So if I'm launching a new piece of technology, there are so many moving parts that for me to sit down and do what's known as a waterfall approach, to say, you know, first we're going to do this, then a month later we'll do this, and then a month later we'll do this, and then maybe 2 years at the end of the process we'll release that technology to the market and hope it works. That is simply too slow. We do not have the ability to predict what's going to happen up front. And I think for us, that's actually been a really insightful and critical piece, not only in how we think about the way we build technology. So as a team, we run Agile, we work on a 2-week sprint cycle. We try and get feedback on everything we're doing on a really regular cadence. But also in terms of what Simprints is able to help organizations improve are their feedback loops, right? It is tough to measure social impact. And there are great methodologies out there, you know, things like randomized control trials, difference in difference methods, cluster sampling. There's a lot of different methodologies, but one of the challenges many of them have is that they're slow.
And expensive.
You know, it can cost you $1 million and take 2 years to run a rigorous RCT, sure, if this program works. And while I think that absolutely has its place in the sector, that's a really slow innovation cycle, right? That's way too slow. With something like Simprints, you can see now real-time data on who's receiving services, when they're receiving services, and where they're receiving services. That starts to create really tight feedback loops now between what's genuinely happening in the field, often the next level up, which is the field managers, all the way up to headquarters. And if you start to get those feedback loops tighter and faster, we think you can make massive operational improvements, actually knowing for the first time what's happening. It's like taking, you know, taking the blindfold off and saying, oh, that's actually what's happening in the field.
Yeah.
This is where we're reaching. This is where we're not. Let's fix that now. Mm-hmm. Let's not fix that in 2 years when the RCT results come back.
Yeah, yeah. And one observation I have about RTC results is that too many organizations do those too early before they have the proof of concept, and they just slow the whole organization down and find out, oh, it doesn't work. They should be spending more time in that iteration phase. You have said, Toby, that the most important resource is the team that you've built. Tell us how you went about building it and what you've learned about building a great team.
So for me, this is critical. I think at the end of the day, actually, in my heart of hearts, I'm an HR nerd. It's to me, talent is the most important part of my role. I think it's one of the most important factors in determining whether or not Simprints and the work and the mission we're trying to achieve will be successful. There's nothing that will make a bigger difference in our success than having great people on board. So I spent a lot of my time and a lot of my headspace thinking about that, and I'm lucky to work with a phenomenal group of advisors, mentors, and supporters to go through that. To give a couple examples of what that looks like in practice, first is we take recruiting incredibly seriously. So we looked at some work that came out of Harvard Business School in terms of how do you do, for example, a value curve. When Simprints is on the talent market and we are trying to steal people from McKinsey and from Google and from Goldman and from all the places where really smart, bright people are going to go, how do we win that talent war, right? And what some of that research shows is that you don't get a marginal benefit from being sort of 40% versus 30% away from salary benchmarks. There's very little return for you for that 10%, you know, underpay. People, if that's their primary motivator, they're always going to go to the higher paying job. So you have to think, where else can we compete? And for a lot of people, salary is only one part of the equation, right? If you look at, for example, autonomy, so how much freedom do they have, how much control over their time, their team. You look at mastery, so the level of professional development, how fast are they learning. You look at purpose, do they connect to the organization's purpose? You look at team and culture. And actually, there is no reason that the nonprofit sector, or more broadly, the social enterprise sector, cannot compete incredibly effectively on those different areas, those different parts of the value curve. And so we make no bones about the fact that we pay low salaries, but we invest heavily in professional development. I think really with sort of the same discipline and the same caliber as I see it, some of my colleagues at McKinsey or BCG. We take team really seriously. We put a ton of effort behind purpose and making sure people have a regular and authentic connection to the North Star. We put a lot of effort into culture, and I think these things matter, and particularly when we look at the millennials who are coming into our organization, these are really important factors, and that's how we steal smart people, convince them to, in some cases, take 5x pay cuts to come work on this mission because it's such an exciting team. They feel so passionate about what we're trying to do. That, I think, is how you win that talent war.
Let me close with this, Toby. How long do you see it taking for this problem, for all intent and purposes, to being solved? A legal identity for everyone by 2030 is one of the sustainable development goals. Do you think that is too ambitious, or do you think it's not ambitious enough?
It's a good question. In my heart, I'm very much an optimist.
Mm-hmm.
I like to think we're going to get there. I think it's going to be bloody difficult. I don't think we're on track at the moment. I think there's a lot more work we need to do between now and then. And I think it's really critical that we see that identity and that right to identity as a stepping stone to access to services, whether it's healthcare, education, finance. And so I think this is the first part of a journey that really could make a lot of difference for a lot of people on the planet, over a billion people. I want to believe we can get there. I know from outside we're going to be working day and night to do everything we can to make it possible. So let's see how this plays out.
It sounds like you will be. Well, Toby Norman, the co-founder and CEO of Simprints, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Where can people learn more about your organization and help you with this work if they should be so inclined?
Thanks very much. If you're interested in the organization, come check us out at www.simprints, that's S-I-M-M for Manchester, P-R-I-N-T-S.com. All the information's there. We work with a grunt of great partners, volunteers, so please get involved. We love your support. And more broadly, let's keep pushing for more transparency and more effectiveness in this space.
And that's also M for Manhattan. Thanks, Toby. It was a pleasure to have you on the program.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks very much.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Tiana was homeless and looking for a change. At Year Up, she gained valuable skills and a path to success. 85% of Year Up alumni are employed or in school within 4 months of graduation. Support transformative opportunities for young adults like Tiana. Visit yearup.org. Follow The Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/BusinessOfGiving. And now, back to The Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
Can you help me remember how to smile?
Every year, billions upon billions of dollars are spent by the international development community to improve the lives of people across the world. But a question to ask about this. How effective can those dollars really be if 4 billion people, many of those same people who are being helped, do not have basic access to justice? An organization that is addressing this epidemic of injustice head-on is NAMIDI. And it's a pleasure to have with us their founder and chief executive officer, Vivek Maru. Good evening, Vivek, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Thank you so much, Denver. Great to be here.
For those who may not be familiar with NAMIDI, what is the mission and goals of the organization?
We deploy community legal workers, sometimes people call them barefoot lawyers, to help people exercise basic rights. Some of the most vulnerable people in the world, we help them to take on the injustices they face.
Mm-hmm. And NAMIDI is a Sanskrit word. What does it mean?
Yeah, NAMIDI is a Sanskrit word. It means to bend something into a curve. And we had in mind that phrase that Martin Luther King would often say, which is that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice.
Mm-hmm.
And so NAMIDI is Sanskrit for bending that curve towards justice.
Got it. You know, as we mentioned, 4 billion people in the world live without basic access to justice. Now, for the most part, Vivek, are there simply no laws on the books to protect these people, or is it a case where the laws are just not being enforced?
That's a good question. It is a mix of those two. There are almost everywhere, even in really difficult places. I just got back from Myanmar last month, for example, which has been a dictatorship for 60 years, and it's still in transition. Even in a very tough, still undemocratic place like Myanmar, there are laws on the books that would afford people some protection. So even in places with weak laws, there are almost always something useful, something to start with. But that is not to say, on the other hand, that anywhere has a perfect set of laws. To the contrary, many laws are designed to repress people. But what we have found is that there is real power in giving ordinary people the ability to understand and use the law as it is, to invoke it, to use it to try to get traction on a problem that they face, and that can kind of be an entry point to ultimately taking part in shaping the law and improving it.
How do you define the law?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like law is this sacred thing. It is supposed to be the language we use to translate our dreams about justice into living institutions that hold us together. It's supposed to be the thing that makes the difference between a society that's ruled by the most powerful and one that honors the dignity of everyone.
Yeah, but it's become very abstract and very cloaked in secrecy. I think that's part of the reason why lawyers, and that is a noble profession,
yeah.
kind of turned sour, the connotation around
yeah.
that word.
I think you're right. I think our profession is taking a hit reputation-wise, and I think we deserve it. I think the law has become too complex, mystified in a way. You know, it's sort of
yeah.
sleeping in courts and books. And but, I mean, living here in the United States, I think many recognize more than ever how important it actually is, how important those laws are, that they belong to all of us. And so when we talk about our philosophy, we say legal empowerment, by which we mean we're trying to demystify law, you
mm-hmm.
know, take away that complexity and make it simple and make it something that ordinary people can make sense of.
Gotcha. You have a long history of social justice, much of it as a result of your grandfather, who was part of the Gandhi movement. What were some of those early lessons for you?
Yeah, my mom's dad. I'm from an immigrant family. My parents came to the United States from India. And in general, I think like many immigrant families, mine was service-oriented and
mm-hmm.
very, very community-oriented, but not too political. I feel like there's a bit of a tradition of kind of keeping your heads down when you're immigrants. But my mom's dad back in India, he did not keep his head down. He was a really dedicated activist and public servant. And one of the things that he taught me was to think about the long game. I mean, he was involved in public life over many decades, and he ran for office several times.
And kept on losing, but kept on running.
Exactly. He kept on losing, kept on running. You know, he spent time in prison during the independence movement. He fell down so many times, but he kept getting back up.
Mm-hmm. You went to Yale Law School, but were a bit disenchanted, as your grandmother told you you would be, and almost dropped out in your first year. What was missing? What was off?
Yeah, I mean, I was struck when I during that first year in law school, I did feel like these dreams I had about the law, that it was supposed to protect everyone, were so distant from the reality that we live in. And the version of law that we were being taught, it seemed kind of narrow and reactionary in contrast to the way in which I thought law might be in society.
Mm-hmm. Well, after law school, you worked a little bit in the circuit court. But then you moved to Sierra Leone at the end of the 11-year war. And the template of what was to become Nnamdi was created. Tell us about that experience.
Yeah, that's right, Denver. When I moved to Sierra Leone in 2003, which was right after the end of a brutal 11-year civil war, people in Sierra Leone recognized, there was kind of a consensus across the society, that among the root causes of that war, like among the basic reasons why people had gone to the bush and picked up guns, was because of maladministration of justice and a kind of arbitrariness in governance. And so there was an interest in doing something going forward. How are we going to keep that from happening again? You know, can we find a way to offer people some basic legal support when they face injustice in their daily lives so that we don't get to that level of social breakdown and alienation that would force us to return to conflict?
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, at the time, there were 100 lawyers total in the country, about 6 million people.
Sure.
And out of that 100, more than 90 were in Freetown, in the capital. And so, plus there's a dual legal system where you have a formal system based on British law, which had been the colonial power, and then you have a customary system based on African tradition. A lot of people turn to the customary institutions, but the lawyers only practice in the formal ones. And so for those reasons, a kind of lawyer-based model of providing legal aid really would have been a non-starter.
Yeah.
And so instead, what we did, and we took inspiration from South Africa, is that we deployed these community legal workers who can kind of be a bridge, who can straddle that formal system and the customary one.
Like community health workers.
Exactly, yeah. In healthcare, we have long realized you don't just have doctors for healthcare, you know. You got many layers. You got nurses and midwives and, as you said, community health workers. And these community paralegals are kind of the equivalent for law. They can bring law close to people and help people find practical solutions, which oftentimes don't involve the courts. They involve the administrative institutions. They involve creative negotiation. During those years living in Sierra Leone and working with communities and paralegals, I started to see a version of the law that I really felt hopeful about.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about these paralegals. I mean, how are they trained? How are they paid? Kind of alluded to, they work through these informal channels. Tell us how they work and get things done.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, we are looking for people who are rooted in the communities they serve,
mm-hmm.
and they have earned the trust of people they serve. They've demonstrated some kind of commitment to the common good, and they have a kind of creative problem-solving ability, and that they can have some basic reading and writing skills. And then we train them in substantive laws and in how government works. And then what they do, I mean, the first step is often legal education. So just letting people know, I mean, just I came from Myanmar last month. One of the first things that community paralegals in Myanmar do is help people to understand what the laws related to land actually say, since there has been so much land grabbing in that society. There's been a lot of theft around land during the dictatorship. So that's one of the first things I'll do is in a community meeting or at a place where people are already gathering or actually on the radio, the community paralegals will help people to understand law, break it down into simple terms.
Sounds like they work with the people as opposed to for the people.
Yes. We often say that. Yeah. I mean, I think a traditional lawyer-client relationship is I'll solve it for you. You know,
mm-hmm.
if you go to a lawyer's office in Freetown, for example, in the capital of Sierra Leone, and you come in with a problem, the lawyer will say something like this to you in Sierra Leonean Creole. He say, "I don't hear you. Left the money. Me go handle it for you. You know, I've heard you. Put some money on the table. I'm going to handle it for you now. You know, I've got you."
Yeah.
And paralegals have a different message. Not I'm going to handle it for you, but we're going to solve it together.
That's really nice. They're taking on some pretty powerful interests. Can this be dangerous work?
It can be, Denver. Yeah. The truth is that it's a brutal world in a lot of places. And we are taking on steep imbalances of power. And paralegals and communities are courageously standing up to those. But yes, there is a risk of retaliation. And we have had paralegals who have had death threats. There are paralegals in our wider network. Now, in addition to kind of deploying paralegals ourselves in six countries, we convene a global network with grassroots groups from all over the world. And there are paralegals that have been killed in our wider network for the work that they do. So yeah, there is. I can't deny it. There is some risk in the work that these people are doing.
Those six countries. What countries are they that you're operating in?
Sierra Leone, which is where I'm headed next week, and where we've worked for a long time. Also in Africa, Kenya and Mozambique, and then a couple places in South Asia, Myanmar I mentioned, and India, which is where my family is from, and then our most recent one, actually, which maybe is backwards in a way, but we're just beginning to try to work with community paralegals here in the United States, in Maryland and D.C., which is near where I live.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that. What areas are you focusing on?
So yeah, in our network, there are people who work on all kinds of things. And that's the thing about law. I mean, you sort of made reference at the beginning, is that it cuts across just about everything you could care about, whether it's environmental protection or the right to health or education or criminal justice. So much of what we care about, the law is relevant for. And if the law is breaking down, then it'll get in the way of well-being. And so in our network, we have people who run the gamut from labor rights to violence against women to prisoners' rights. In the work that Numathi is doing directly, we have tried to go deep on four issues. And those are citizenship rights, so people who can't access papers because they face discrimination when they try to get an identity card. And so that's one. And then another one is the right to health. So people who live in places where there are decent healthcare policies, but there's oftentimes a big breakdown in delivery, like no running water in the local health clinic, or the nurse is not showing up to work. And paralegals help people to understand what health policy says and to get solutions to grievances. And then the other couple areas where we work are community land rights and environmental justice or environmental enforcement.
Well, let's take community land rights if we can.
Yeah.
A lot can happen when a person is cajoled to putting their thumbprint on a piece of paper which leases their prized possession, their land, away for a long, long time. Tell us about this practice, the consequences of it, and what your organization is doing to make it right.
Thank you. Yeah. Yes, there are many, many people around the world. There was one estimate that it's about 1 billion people around the world who live on land that they think of as their own. They have occupied it for generations. They depend on it for their livelihood, whether it's farming or grazing or fishing or some combination of those. And yet they don't have formal legal rights to it. They don't have a piece of paper. They don't have a map. And when you don't have those things, you are vulnerable, because right now there is a huge amount of demand for exactly that land, for mining, for agribusiness. And so there are communities around the world who, because of those insecure legal rights, are vulnerable to having their land taken from them, or, as you said, kind of getting hoodwinked or cajoled into endorsing, you know, you mentioned putting their thumbprints, because they can't read and write, their thumbprints on lease agreements, sometimes 50-year, sometimes 99-year lease agreements.
In return for nothing.
In return for very little.
Yeah,
like
pittance.
$2, exactly. Yeah. $2 an acre per year for 50 years. And that is the thing that they depend upon the most.
Mm-hmm.
And so what community paralegals can do about that is they can educate people up front about opportunities. In many places, there actually is a law in the books that allows communities to document their lands and to secure their legal rights and to set up governance arrangements over those lands so that they do have the power to make decisions about them. And so paralegals can help communities go through that process to map their lands, document their boundaries, set up governance arrangements, which is a hugely empowering thing. I mean, if you sit down with a community that now has a title and a map to the land that they've had for a long time, that itself is empowering. And then if an investor does come along, paralegals can help communities to negotiate with that investor in an empowered way, and also to take part in the public processes that set the terms on that investment.
That's cool. And also, in some of these lease agreements, there is an option to renegotiate, so that when that comes up, they say, let's get a little bit better deal here.
Absolutely.
Or no deal at all.
Absolutely.
Well, closely connected to that would be environmental laws.
Yes.
And they are ignored and disregarded and certainly not enforced. You do so much work around that. Give us a story.
Absolutely, yeah. My family, as I said, is from India, and India's got a strong environmental regulatory framework on paper, but a huge enforcement gap. And in many places, companies are just ignoring the commitments that they are under. And so what we have seen is that paralegals in many places are able to help the communities who are living in the shadow of those industrial facilities to, again, understand what the rules say, mm-hmm. and then to pursue enforcement, not to go to court, but to go to administrative institutions. And so we've got many stories. There is an estuary in South India, a place called Uttara Kannada, which is like a district in the state of Karnataka. And there are people who harvest clams for a living,
mm-hmm.
And they are dependent on that estuary for harvesting clams. And paralegals help them do a couple things. One is the folks who do the clam harvesting had historically been excluded from forming a union. And they had been excluded from some basic benefits that, for example, fisher people receive. Like if a fisherman dies at sea, the Indian government has kind of an insurance scheme that the family receives something. And someone was diving for clams and died, but his wife couldn't receive anything because they weren't recognized as a traditional livelihood. And,
uh-huh.
and part of that was because their caste was different from the caste of the people who typically practice fishing. And so paralegals help them for the first time to register as a union and to get recognition for this livelihood, which, again, is a form of, you know, you're sort of invisible, you're not recognized under the law, and you go from there to actually having recognition, having formal rights. The other thing that paralegals have been doing is that there's a proposal to build a huge port right there on that estuary, which would destroy the natural resources that these people depend on. And so paralegals have been helping communities to understand what that proposal is and to take part in these public conversations about whether that should happen, and if so, on what terms.
Good stuff. Can paralegals get enough data? And that's from all the cases that they're collectively working on. And then make a case to the government that the system needs to be changed.
Absolutely, Denver. Yeah, I mean, I was saying that our mantra is no law, use law, shape law. You know, we want everybody to be able to do all three of those things. And
mm-hmm.
so, yeah, you put your finger on it, is that if you track data on the cases that paralegals handle, all these attempts to try to get justice out of the system as it is now, that gives you, when you put it together, a detailed portrait of how that system is working in practice. And people can use that information to argue for improvements to laws and policies. So, for example, in India, we have the paralegals observed over time the way a certain set of policies around the handling of coal mm-hmm. were really helpful to communities, that they could use those policies, for example, around how when coal is handled, how it needs how fugitive dust needs to be prevented. And they were able to use those policies to get concrete solutions, but they found that there were no similar guidelines for other minerals. And so they have proposed, and the government in Gujarat state has in principle accepted this, a new set of guidelines addressing other kinds of minerals. And so suddenly you go from helping hundreds or thousands of people to being able to get a systemic change that affects the lives of millions of people. And we've seen that over and over in many different countries, how that knowledge and that experience mm-hmm. of trying to use the law, when you put it together, it can be a really powerful basis from which to propose and advocate for improvements to law.
Absolutely. You touched on this a little while ago, but I think a lot of people might be surprised that you're operating here in the United States, as you said, in the Washington metro area. And much of that work has been around the housing crisis. What kind of things are you doing?
We're just getting started. I think you might be referring on housing to this this really powerful example, which actually Numathi wasn't involved in, of how community paralegals can be effective mm-hmm. here. I was right here in New York City, and there's this paralegal program which a judge in New York endorsed, where very low stipend, you know, basically volunteers help people in housing court to understand housing law and advocate for themselves. And researchers talked to 150 people who had help from these paralegals. And normally in New York, 1 in 9 of the tenants who gets brought to housing court gets evicted.
Mm-hmm.
But when researchers talked to 150 people who had help from paralegals, they found no evictions at all, not one. And so it shows how like a little bit of legal empowerment can go a long way. The work that we are kind of scoping in down in D.C. in Maryland is related to environmental justice, because actually the conditions I was describing in India, mm-hmm. they aren't that
foreign to here.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, we here as well have a situation where we have a rigorous and sophisticated environmental regulatory regime. We do have a lot of gaps in that regime and a lot of noncompliance. I mean, the Patuxent River, for example, mm-hmm. which flows through Maryland and flows through a lot of communities of color and a lot of poor people's communities. There are over 100 facilities on that river that are in noncompliance openly. And so we are looking at the possibility of working with local community members, again, to play this role of legal empowerment, to make sure that communities themselves understand what the rules say mm-hmm. and are able to use those rules to protect themselves, to protect their environment, their health, and their livelihoods.
Yeah. Let me close with this, Vivek. Speak about hope as opposed to despair. And we all know the importance of hope in a person's life, but we don't frequently associate it with the law. But tell us how you have seen the law used in a way that has given a person and a community hope.
I do think that the law can and should be almost a vehicle for living out our hope, because the law is so crucial for democracy itself. I was in Kenya before I was in Myanmar, so earlier this summer. There's a guy there named Mahmoud Ratib. He said it's okay to say his name. In 1985, he got pickpocketed,
mm-hmm.
and someone stole his wallet, and his ID card was in his wallet. And for a normal, he's from Kenya. He's born and raised in Nairobi. And for normal Kenyans, for your average Kenyan, that is not a big deal. It takes you a couple weeks, you get a new ID card. In his case, because he is from one of the several tribes that faces discrimination when trying to get an ID card, altogether there are 5 million people in Kenya with this situation where they face almost like a Jim Crow process.
Yeah.
It's really hard for them to get ID cards. He got bounced around from agency to agency, from the police to the security officials and back. He got asked for all kinds of things he didn't have. He ended up giving up, and he had to stop working. He had been a truck driver. He went that way for 29 years without an ID card, unable to work. Then a community paralegal from his community helped him to understand how that system for ID administration works, helped him gather the documents he needed to make a case for himself. And he was finally able to get an ID again. He drives a truck again. He has a life again. He said, you know, I have my life back now. And so that's just one of many, many examples examples I've seen over time of how if you take the law seriously and if you put the power of law in people's hands, people can go from despair to hope.
Well, a sweet story to end on. Well, Vivek Maru, the founder and CEO of Nomity, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Is there anything people can do, can act upon, to be part of this movement of providing access to justice for all?
Great question, Denver. Yeah, I would say three things. I would say, number one is invest. You know, if you whether you have $10, $100, or $1 million, consider putting some of that into grassroots legal empowerment. It is the right thing to do. It matters for its own sake, and it also is essential for just about everything else we care about, whether it's environmental protection or health care or well-being or fighting poverty. This question of law and justice cuts across all of those. So invest is one. And then second is wherever you are, to argue that with your public officials, with your representatives, that this question of basic legal support, it ought to be a public priority. It ought to be one of the things that a society owes its people. And right now, that is not the case in rich countries or poor countries. Yeah. Legal aid is totally underfunded across the board. And then the third thing I would say is consider being a community paralegal in your own life. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have to have a special training. Think about, is there a problem or an injustice near where you live? You know, is the river that flows through the city that you live in being poisoned? Are there people who are working without proper safety gear near where you live? Get to know the people most affected. Figure out what the rules say with them. Try to figure out what the rules say. See if you can use those rules to get a solution. And if you can't, work on trying to shape those rules. Because if we all start knowing, using, and shaping the law, I think we will be together building that deeper version of democracy that is so essential.
We're all paralegals. Well, thanks, Vivek. It was a real delight to have you on the show.
Thank you, Denver. Thanks so much for having me.
And that is this week's show. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. And do return next Sunday evening for The Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of The Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.